Today's title, There is a Friend That Sticketh Closer Than a Brother.
Good morning, brothers and sisters.
Good morning. Good morning.
Gets louder as the day goes on. Yesterday, brothers and sisters, we were introducing ourselves to the two periods which we want to concentrate on by way of study in David's life. Those two phases being the years when David fled as a fugitive from Saul, and those years in which, or during that time, which he was a fugitive from his own home in Jerusalem, subsequent to Absalom's rebellion. We introduced ourselves yesterday also to basic perspectives or principles drawn from both the New Testament and the Old that help us to understand why it is God wishes all of his people to view themselves and to experience the life of a pilgrim and a sojourner. One of the last passages we considered yesterday, if you recall, was from the book of Leviticus, in which the Israelites were told that even after they had been settled in their land under Joshua, they were to view themselves, even in their settled condition, as strangers and sojourners. And it is from that perspective, brothers and sisters, that we wish to continue our study of David's life as a fugitive this morning. We were looking yesterday in the area of about 1 Samuel chapter 18. Would you open your Bibles with me, please, to 1 Samuel chapter 19. We will pick up the threads from that context this morning. Following the incident in which David flees from his own help, from his own house, excuse me, with the assistance of his wife, in chapter 19, verse 18, we're told, "So David fled and escaped." That really represents a refrain, brothers and sisters, I'm sure you're aware of. A refrain that follows David now for some 12 years as he begins this life of a fugitive. David, time and again, will flee and ultimately escape. It's repeated in verse 12 of the same chapter. You'll notice how the two words are used again in verse 10, just previous to that. David fled and escaped. He faced his troubles. He came very close to not escaping. He was forced, in circumstance after circumstance, to rely more fully on the providential deliverance of God. But one thing David was to come to know by experience and by firm conviction was the fact that if he fled from the wrong kind of influences, he would escape. Now, by way of perspective again this morning, I'd like just, if you would, to hold your hand here in the Samuel context. I'd like you to go and look at a passage written by Paul in Corinthians. 1 Corinthians, chapter 10. The context of 1 Corinthians chapter 10 deals with an admonition to the Corinthian brethren to sever themselves from all of the associations that some of them are still maintaining with former temple worship, association by way of fellowship with the temple and with pagan idolatry. His exhortation, developed in chapter 8, 9, and chapter 10 here, develops a series of practical exhortations to the brethren to maintain their separation from the world and not to think that they could have fellowship with God and also maintain fellowship with idolatrous practices. Now, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, there is a perspective here that relates on our section this morning. Verse 12, 1 Corinthians 10. Paul warns, "Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." And then he continues, verse 13, There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to men. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will, with the temptation, also make a way of escape, that ye may be able to bear it. That really is a very important perspective to keep in mind when we view David's life as a fugitive. It is not an assurance that we will not be tempted. It is not an assurance that we will not have trials and difficulties come across our paths. It is certainly not an assurance that our faith will never be sorely tested, for it will. But it is an assurance that if we remain faithful and do our part, God will not tempt us beyond what we are able to bear, and with the temptation will provide a way of escape. Now, the word escape there in the Greek means passageway. It's in fact the same basic term used in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 in reference to the passing of the people of Israel through the Red Sea. Verses 1 and 2 refers back to that historical incident when the people of Israel passed through the sea, verse 1, by way of deliverance from Egypt. Now notice, brothers and sisters, in this context, one other perspective that's worth bearing in mind. Verse 14 follows up from the apostle's comment in verse 13. And the connecting thought is with that word, wherefore. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. And David fled, we read, and escaped. He fled and escaped. Those two worked together in unison. Had David not taken some initiative, had he not cooperated in the process himself, had he not realized that he needed to flee and at least taken that part on himself, he would not have escaped. You see the point, brothers and sisters, as we follow David's life, we will see time and again that the success of his escape depended upon his willing cooperation to flee. Now the point in the context here of 1 Corinthians 10 is ever so relevant. The point that he's stressing to the Corinthians is they cannot flirt with idolatry. They cannot have fellowship with Christ and go back to that temple worship or fraternize in any way with the temple associations, which some of the brethren thought they could and be untouched. He will provide a way of escape like he did with Moses and the people. But remember the posture, Paul tells them. They came to the brink of the Red Sea with Pharaoh's army rushing in behind them. They stood and they looked out over that sea. There was the temptation. Were they going to go back and give in to Pharaoh? Were they going to return to Egypt? No, they weren't. Under Moses' direction, which was the right posture, they looked ahead of themselves. And they took the initiative to flee. And at the temptation, in the hour of crisis, the sea opened up and God provided a way of escape. But the key is verse 14. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. If they had not have taken that initiative, if they had not cooperated with Yahweh, in fleeing Egypt, in the hour of temptation, they would not have had a way of escape. Now, as we go back to the life of David, brothers and sisters, and we look at that refrain in 1 Samuel 19, verse 10, verse 12, verse 18, David fled and escaped. David fled and escaped. Both of those thoughts are very close to what we're saying, what Paul was saying in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Fleeing and taking that posture will bring with it God's providential blessing as long as we cooperate in that process. It's not an assurance then that David would not face trials or that we will not face trials. But rather, in our trials, if we take the posture that David took successfully many, many times, the posture of fleeing turning our backs on the world's way of thinking, turning our backs on fleshly thinking. And despite our weaknesses, and despite our doubts, and our failings of faith, if we're in the posture of fleeing and turning our backs on the temptation, then God will provide a passageway. He will provide a way of escape. Now, in the case of 1 Samuel 19, the scenario was often going to be repeated. Michal is the agent in this case. She provides for God the agency whereby God providentially can work in David's life and through Michal provide for David a way of escape. Let's just pursue this context a little further. As we go down through chapter 19, brothers and sisters, starting from verse 18, we find that he flees to Samuel. Verse 18, he flees to his old companion. Samuel now is well worn in years. He is residing in Ramah, in what was basically called the school of the prophets. Here, Samuel provided the kind of peace and help that David needed. But as we proceed down to verse 19 and 20, David's place of residence is known, and the information is conveyed to Saul. And so, Saul responds, as he will often respond from this time on. Verse 21, when it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they prophesied also. Then went he also to Ramah, and came to a great well that is in Succoth. And he asked and said, where are Samuel and David? And one said, behold, they be at Naoth in Ramah. And so Saul pursues. But we find when he gets into the area of where David is, verse 23 and 24, unintentionally, without his desire, Saul is turned into a prophet. God's miraculous, providential hand works on the heart and mind of Saul. And he virtually takes one of David's enemies and he turns him into, temporarily, one who is as a prophet. You see the assurance to David here at the outset of his fugitive life? There is a warning note to Saul and the enemies that God will intervene and God will work with his person whom he loves, David. But there's also an encouragement here to David at the outset. Although this scenario is going to be repeated time and time again, God is showing David the extent to which he, God, will intervene in David's life. The extent to which he will turn his enemies right around. And we think of the proverb, fulfilled rather remarkably here, that when a man pleases the Lord, he will make even his enemies to be at peace with him. And that was fulfilled here in a way that was unparalleled in any previous experience in David's life. Now, as we go into chapter 20, there are some interesting developments that emerge in terms of David relates to this first great challenge in fleeing from Saul. For we read in verse 1 of chapter 20, David fled from Naoth in Ramah. Now, that means he left the presence of Samuel. David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, what have I done? What is mine iniquity? And what is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life? David, brothers and sisters, we believe is becoming unhinged. That kind of pleading is not typical of David's reaction to these circumstances when he is strong in his faith. But let's just pursue it. Verse 2. And he said unto him, God forbid, says Jonathan, thou shalt not die. Behold, my father will do nothing, either great or small, but that he will show it me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. And David sware moreover and said, thy father certainly knoweth that I have found grace in thine eyes. And he saith, let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death. That is not, brothers and sisters, the kind of statement that David makes when he's in a position of true, faithful strength. We can see here that Jonathan is needed to reassure David as a true friend. David is experiencing considerable distress under the pressure of the circumstances. And we sense by the way he speaks in verse 1 and then rejoins in verse 3 that there is a mounting frustration, a sense of despair in David at this point. And Jonathan seems to understand what David really is getting at by his pleadings in verse 1. Although David does not say in verse 1 that he shall die by the hand of Saul, verse 2 seems to indicate that Jonathan understands his meaning. For he says, by way of reassurance, God forbid thou shalt not die. In other words, Jonathan's retort discloses what he understood David really to be saying. David feared death. He feared that he was going to be killed by Saul. And the reassurance that Jonathan then provides is intended to pour balm on David's troubled soul, to give him the reassurance that he needs. Now, as we go down just a little further, notice what David resorts to. Verse 6, in his dialogue with Jonathan, verse 6, he says to Jonathan, if thy father at all miss me, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me, that he might run to Bethlehem, his city, and there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. If he say thus, that's Saul, if he does say thus, it is well, thy servant shall have peace. But if he be very wroth, then be sure that evil is determined by him. You see what David is counseling Jonathan to do. He is counseling Jonathan to give in to deception. What is being conveyed here to Saul is not true, for David, as we read in the context, later resides out where it's safe, beyond this area where he dialogues with Jonathan. There is a pattern beginning to emerge which we'll see repeated more than once in David's life. When David does fall to weakness, and he does have those weaker moments, there is a pattern, and the pattern seems to be developing around these verses. He begins to let distress and frustration dominate his feelings and his reactions. He lacks faith, at least more than he normally has. Furthermore, he is concerned about his own life, and he is fearing Saul as being the ultimate conqueror. And in these moments of weakness, the one next step, as disclosed in verse 6, is that David begins to resort to lie or deception in order to save himself. In other words, although David has not lost total faith by any means, in these weaker moments, he begins to question how much God is going to really be true to his word. He knows that he's to be the king. He's been told that. He's been given a covenant later on that assures him from other things said earlier in his life that he will be the king. He is to be the Lord's anointed. Then why speak of death? Why speak of Saul as though he's going to be victorious? Because his faith at this point is faltering. And when it does falter, he resorts to stratagems of his own. He resorts to deception and sometimes blatant lie in order to try and manipulate the circumstances and assist himself. Now, as we read the rest of chapter 20 here, we find that Jonathan cooperates as a faithful friend in David's request. So two of them then become involved in the deception as they try to excuse David's presence from the banquet. But when we come over one chapter further, chapter 21, we find David moving on after this crisis to Nob, a small little town, shouldering Jerusalem, just slightly to the north of Jerusalem, a very small town where, it would seem, a number of the priests resided. Now, I just want you to notice how what seems to be a bit of a downward slide in chapter 20 seems to continue on the decline. Verse 1 of chapter 21. Then came David to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David, and said unto him, Why art thou alone, and no man with thee? Now watch David's response. And David said unto Ahimelech, or it could be Abiathar if you check your margin, David said unto Ahimelech the priest, The king hath commanded me a business, and hath said unto me, Let no man know anything of the business, whereabout I send thee, and what I have commanded thee, and I have appointed my servants to such and such a place. Verse 2 is a lie. That is not true. He is really not conveying the true reason as to why David is in this vicinity and why he has come to Nob. We know, as we look at the rest of chapter 21 here, that he begs bread of Abiathar. But something else to notice. Here in chapter 21, verse 8, David said unto Ahimelech, And is there not here under thine hand spear or sword? For I have neither brought my sword nor my weapons with me. Now he returns to the story. Because the king's business required haste, which wasn't true. Verse 9. And the priest said, The sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom thou slewest in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If thou wilt take that, take it. For there is none other save that here. And David said, There is none like that. Give it me. Now, ponder this for a moment, brothers and sisters. What is David doing here, begging the sword of Goliath? Its size and its weight and its cumbersomeness really would have provided a very ineffectual weapon for David. And why is David resorting to reliance on a sword in order to face Saul? Does he really think that he's going to confront Saul face to face in some kind of an armed combat and be able to employ Goliath's sword against Saul? In David's better moments, he confesses that he will not raise his hand against the Lord's anointed, so long as he lived. David continues a kind of downward slide here. Consider the contrast of what he just asks for and the way he's looking at his circumstances here with something that David himself said earlier. Let's hold our hands here and go back to 1 Samuel 17. Here was the perspective that David expressed when he faced Goliath at the peak of David's faith. 1 Samuel 17. Verse 45 and 47. This is a different perspective, a faithful perspective. Verse 45. Then said David to the Philistine, Thou comest to me with a sword, and with a spear, and with a shield. But I come to thee in the name of Yahweh of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. The very point that David made in rebuke to Goliath was that he did not come to him with sword and spear and armor. He came in faith of Yahweh of hosts. Verse 47, David says, And all this assembly, in the Septuagint, the word is the word ecclesia, all this ecclesia shall know that Yahweh saveth, not with sword and spear, for the battle is Yahweh's, and he will give you into our hands. Now, if that was true, in facing an ungodly Gentile Philistine, how much truer was it in terms of how David was to effect his escape from Saul? Was he really going to turn the tables of these principles? And in facing Saul, employ Goliath's butchering weapon against the Lord's anointed? It's not a moment of strength for David. And once again, we notice that David has temporarily, and we stress that, temporarily lacked the kind of perspective or faith that he expressed here on one of his stronger moments against Goliath in 1 Samuel 17. Now, if, brothers and sisters, previously, we have had a hard time identifying with David, because we see David in our mind's eye as one who was an unfaltering man of God who really never, ever failed. Our perspective has not been truly clear. If we have felt, moreover, that the only time that David failed or lacked faith was when he did what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah, that too is not a clear picture of David's life. David, we will discover, fails in lesser ways, of course, than his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah. He fails in lesser ways, but his failures follow a pattern. And once we perceive what that pattern is, there's an exhortation to ourselves that when we are in crisis, when we face a challenge to our faith, when our loyalty to God taxes us, we do well to remember that there often is a pattern which, if we put our foot to it, will often follow right through, as it did often with David. Once we begin to doubt God's word, once we begin to look too closely at the temporary circumstances, once, like David, we think too much about Saul, too much about the power and strength that he has, and our faith begins to falter, we will begin that downward path. And in that downward path, like David's, there'll be often one other ingredient that goes along with it: the temptation to resort to our own methods or strategies to get ourselves out. When we begin to resort to those kind of strategies, as David did, we will often be tempted to act in a somewhat guiling or deceptive way. David, under pressure, in those circumstances, when his faith slipped, more than once fell to deception and to lies. Brothers and sisters, when we do fall, and when we do sense that our faith is weakening, let us remember the kind of pattern that we find in these men of faith when they did fail. And if we sense where we are in that pattern and become aware of what we're doing, like David, we can, by God's grace, more effectively pull ourselves out of it with God's help. Now, as we concentrate on this time when he's in Nob, there's a next step we should follow. Back to 1 Samuel 21. What does David do with this sword, and where does he go from here? Verse 10, the downward slide continues. And David arose and fled, verse 10, that day, for fear of Saul, and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Place names are important. Gath was the home of Goliath. David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul, and went to Achish, the king of Gath. One extra step in this downward slide, which proves to be almost fatal to the man David. He removes himself from the immediate vicinity of the ecclesia. It was the ecclesia that David was concerned about when he faced Goliath, when he said, as we just read in chapter 17, before Yahweh and this assembly, or this ecclesia, I will show to you what faith in God can do. But now, David's on the run. David is now preoccupied by fear, not by faith. And it is for fear of Saul that he now leaves the ecclesia, where the brothers and sisters are in Judah. And he places himself now in a very worldly environment. How worldly? In the land of the Philistines. He places himself now in Gentile territory. Not only that, he places himself in the hometown of Goliath. Now, verse 11. And the servants of Achish said unto him, is not this David, the king of the land? Notice that. Isn't this the king of the land? What's he doing creeping into this town? Did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul hath slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And David laid up these words in his heart and was sore afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. David, in other words, according to verse 12, is privy to these musings by the Philistines in this town, verse 11. David knows that they're wondering about him. David is aware that they're really saying behind closed doors, "Isn't this the man that slew Goliath? Isn't this the man that has accomplished greater things than Saul already? Isn't this the one that they have sung songs of victory to? Why then is he fleeing Saul? Why is he coming here to Gath of all places?" Keep in mind one other detail. When David came to Gath, he had something in his hand. Picture the scene. Here is the hometown of Goliath. Here is the man who has slain Goliath and caused the Philistines to flee in the past. Here is the man who has, by his own people's recognition, the hand of God's blessing over Saul. Now he comes creeping into Gath, dragging the sword of Goliath beside him. The irony of the scene, brothers and sisters, as you think of it in your mind's eye. Can you imagine him going back to Gath with the sword of Goliath dragging by his side and begging for asylum, for protection in Goliath's hometown? No wonder the people murmured. The bitter and sad irony of the scene. This is not David at his best. But it is David, like you and I. It is David at a weaker, more human point. It shows us that apart from his failings with Bathsheba and Uriah, David did have other times of weakness. And as we follow through, notice how the web becomes even more entangled. For now, David, receiving asylum in Gath, is in a fix, we would say. He's not only afraid of Saul, now who's he afraid of? Verse 12. He's now afraid of Achish. Fear, not faith. And verse 13, how is David going to effect his release from these circumstances? Verse 13, he, now David, resorting once again to his own stratagems, he changed his behavior before them, and feigned himself mad in their hands, and scrabbled on the doors of the gate, and let his spittle fall down upon his beard. This is David. This is the man who faced Goliath with no armor, who came out in the name of Yahweh of hosts. It's not to mock David. It's not to gloat over David, but it's to see that David here is in a spiritual valley, brothers and sisters. And if we've ever had difficulties in the past identifying with men of faith like David, an awareness of these failings in David's life helps us to come much closer to his companionship. For in his strengths, in emulating the successes of David in our own lives, we can do that much easier and come much closer to David when we are aware that he too had our failings. Now, what happens? Well, verse 14. Then said Achish unto his servants, "Lo, ye see the man is mad. Wherefore then have ye brought him to me? Have I need of a madman, that ye have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" And David finally is released. There are psalms written, brothers and sisters, at this time, or at least relating to this time, that throw considerable light on David's understanding. It is perhaps a reflection of what David was to learn from these circumstances. Would you hold your hand here and go over to Psalm 34? If you have a pencil, you might find it useful at the point of 1 Samuel 21, around verses 14 or 15, to jot in your margin that Psalm 34 relates to this period. I'd like you just to see what David says about the circumstances on reflection. What did David learn from this crisis and his failures? Well, you'll see the inscription at the beginning, or the superscription in the beginning of Psalm 34, a psalm of David. And this, by the way, is not something that is an editorial comment from the Bible editors. This is in the Hebrew text. A psalm of David when he changed his behavior before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. Now then, Psalm 34 throws light on these circumstances. Now, what did David say about it when he reflected? Well, verse 3. David says, "Oh, magnify Yahweh with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought Yahweh, and he heard me, and delivered me from all my fears." Now that should bring to your remembrance that statement in verse 10 of 1 Samuel 21. David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul. And it should remind us of verse 12. David laid up his words in his heart and was sore afraid of Achish. Fear was the demon here. David's preoccupation with the temporary circumstances and the power of these human individuals went a long ways to weakening his faith. "The Lord, however, delivered me from all my fears." Keeping in mind how he professed himself to be a madman, verse 6 takes on special meaning. It's a very graphic picture of himself. "This poor man cried." When you think of David acting and feigning himself to be mad. "This poor man cried, and Yahweh heard him, and saved him out of all his troubles." Do you know, brothers and sisters, there's a point here we can't miss. There will be times when, like David, we will falter. There will be times when we make the wrong decision. We'll be embarrassed, humiliated, and distressed by our own lack of faithfulness. And on those occasions, we may feel embarrassed to go to God in prayer. We may feel that God is disappointed with us. We may feel that since we have failed so miserably, we really have no right to resort to God any further in prayer. That's the mentality of Judas. When Judas failed and the error was pointed out to him, he was only of the mind to finally go out and kill himself. Peter failed, but in Peter's failure, no matter how many times he had failed previously, he resorted to God once again, trusting that he would forgive 70 times 7, as the Lord had told him in the ministry. Brothers and sisters, when we do fail, we must, like David in his confession here in Psalm 34, square with ourselves. We must get down on our hands and knees and confess and admit to ourselves before God that we have failed. But we never need to feel, brothers and sisters, that because we have failed more than once, or because we have now repeated an error that we have done many times before, that there's no longer any patience with God. And verse 7, what David was to have learned in those circumstances, what would have made David victorious, verse 7, was this perspective. "The angel of Yahweh encampeth round about them that fear him." Not Achish, not Saul, not the Philistines. Those that fear God. That was the key. It was a lack of faith and outlook along those lines that caused David to slip on that occasion. Furthermore, verse 13, here is David almost exhorting himself, considering the guile and the deception which led David to that very sorry state. The deceiving of Saul as the excuse that he'd given to Jonathan. The profaning himself to be mad before Achish when David was not mad. The story that he had on more than one occasion spun that had got him into difficulties is now really being addressed here in verse 13. "Keep thy tongue from evil, and thy lips Now notice the relevance of this statement. And thy lips from speaking guile. David knew what his problem was, and upon reflection realized that he had been given to guile on a number of occasions that led up to that spiritual valley. But back to 1 Samuel, chapter 22. Verse 1 of chapter 22. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam. We're going to pick up this context one class from now, but I want you to notice, what are the circumstances, brothers and sisters, which effect a change in David's faithfulness to God? One, he is removed from the world. That is, he is removed from Gath. He is removed from the area of the Philistines. He gets himself out of Gath. And where does he place himself? By God's help, in chapter 22, verse 1, back a little closer to the ecclesia. He's going to advance even closer, as we'll see in another class. And it will be done by way of admonition from Gad the seer. But David, at least now, geographically, places himself closer to the ecclesia, out of the world's environment and in God's environment. And it is by that change that the trial is terminated. The circumstances reversed, and David, as we proceed through chapter 22, experiences a change for the good. His circumstances improve. Because David returns to the ecclesial setting, because he now begins to work out, with God's help, his trial in the context of the ecclesial or the community's environment, God's with him. He is still going to flee from Saul. He will still be a fugitive for about another 10 years. He will still experience failures at times and frustrations and lack of faith. But in the overall, he will succeed and be triumphant in his faith. But the arena of his activities is going to be within Judah. And it is there where God, in the overall picture, brings David success. Do you know, brothers and sisters, when we look out in the community today, we see many things which distress us. We find weaknesses on arranging boards. We find decisions which are not wise for the community as a whole. We find brethren and sisters writing, speaking things which do not sit square with the truth as we know it and understand it. We find deviations from our original professions of faith within our community at times. We find moral declension within Christadelphian communities today or within Christadelphian ecclesias. If you look closely enough, you will not have any difficulty discovering that the Christadelphian community has its failings and its weaknesses. Now, what is your posture going to be, and what's mine going to be? To remove ourselves to Gath? To remove ourselves from the geographical closeness of the community and the ecclesia? To think that we can solve the weaknesses of Judah by going to Gath? Can we effectively work with the sheep that need assistance and work with those weaknesses within the body by pretending ourselves to be a surgeon out of the body? What will be our response, brothers and sisters, when we find those kinds of problems? What David was later told in chapter 22 by Gad the seer in verse 5 was to stay in the ecclesia, to remain with the sheep, despite the fact that many were weak. There needed to be some that needed visiting, needed feeding, needed strengthening, wounds that needed to be healed, diseases that needed to be addressed. But David was told to stay in Judah in order to do that, not to remove himself and fix a great gulf between himself and the ecclesia and at a distance offer prescriptions across the valley. David, get out of Gath and go back to the ecclesia. That perspective, as we see in the rest of 22, he met with success in the overall. Still had problems, still had challenges. There were still times when he was frustrated and distressed. But when in Judah, David in the overall met with God's blessings. It's there that God intended him to be. Now, there are aspects of David's life as a fugitive which can be viewed as exhortational to ourselves, especially in this first phase, from another perspective other than seeing David's failings. It's not to gloat over them, but to be warned by them, and of course, as we've said, to be alerted to those patterns which emerged in David's life when we see those patterns emerging in our life. They're warning signals. Apart from that, we can look now at David's life as a fugitive and see how it was God encouraged David. What did he do for David when David cooperated? How did he strengthen David during those hours of stress and loneliness? Number one, brothers and sisters, he did provide Jonathans in David's life. Who are the Jonathans? The Jonathans are those fellow brethren and sisters which, if we remain in their company and solicit their friendship and their advice, the Jonathans are those brothers and sisters whom, if we are close enough to them and know them already well, when we face a crisis, will behave as Jonathans to us. Let's just notice the environment here. Number one, we've already seen how Jonathan has, in chapter 20, verse 2, admonished David not to be faithless. And although David did not entirely respond at that point to Jonathan's wiser counsel, he was nevertheless giving David some strength. He was remaining loyal to David. And his admonition, had it been followed, would have kept David out of the difficulties that he finally fell to. I want you to turn to chapter 23, if you will. Later on, this is in the area of the wilderness of Ziph, which is still within the vicinity of Judah. 1 Samuel 23, verse 14, David is on the run again. Now watch how Jonathan performs the role of a loyal friend, a fellow brother, and helps David. Verse 14, David abode in the wilderness and strongholds, and remained in a mountain in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day. What kind of a trial is that, brothers and sisters? The threads of David's patience must have run very, very thin on those days. But God delivered him not into his hand. And David saw that Saul was come out to seek his life. And David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a wood. Verse 16. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David into the wood and strengthened his hand in God. We will face the trials of David, perhaps to a much lesser degree. There will be times, even though we are working in the community the way we should be, and even though we are in Judah as we should be and not in Gath, our faith will be tested. We will still go through and be put into the crucible of testing that our faith might be refined. But to help us, brothers and sisters, there are Jonathans. We're going to be meeting some other of David's friends in the next class. But notice how a brother or a sister performs by God's agent a balm and a soothing oil to David's troubled soul. He strengthened his fellow brother's hand in God. And look at his words, Jonathan's, in verse 17. He said unto him, "Fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee. And thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee. And that also Saul my father knoweth." Brothers and sisters, our closing note, which we'll develop more in our next class. You've got to know Jonathans to be helped by Jonathans. If you do not know your brothers and sisters in your home ecclesia, if you have not taken time to cultivate a true, close bond with your brothers and sisters, you will not have the Jonathans to help you when you need them. If you have not invested time and effort in getting to know your fellow brothers and sisters, first within your own ecclesia, but secondly, beyond the precincts of that ecclesia, the community as a whole, if during this week at Bible school you make very little effort to get to know your fellow brothers and sisters, you will not have the Jonathans when you need them. And there are Jonathans, I'm sure, in every ecclesia. And there are exceptional Jonathans, perhaps, beyond your own ecclesia. But if you know them, and they know you, a telephone call, a letter, a trip to visit them in the hour of crisis will help you to get out of Gath. Brothers and sisters, let us appreciate, therefore, the force of that proverb which has entitled our talk, that there is a friend that sticketh closer even than our own fleshly brother. And that's our fellow brothers and sisters. Let us, brothers and sisters, cultivate that friendship, that bond of brotherhood. And let us, brothers and sisters, develop the kind of bond that should exist between brothers and sisters in the unity of the one body, so that when we have our hours of crisis, we can find the Jonathans, or we can be the Jonathan we ought to be.